Good morning. You're listening to the KBCW Local News Hour. It's 8:15, and I have Summit County Manager Tom Fisher in the office, in the station here, and he's here to talk about the council meeting, which is coming up tomorrow. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Carolyn. So when I show up tomorrow, what are we going to talk about?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. Do you have any other uniforms?
I have no other roles to except husband and father to deal with.
Okay, well, that's plenty. So welcome. Thanks for coming in again. So the council is starting off this afternoon's meeting with a field trip to Chalk Creek Road, which runs east of Colville. And I guess there's some consideration about linking that road up to the Mirror Lake Highway. And the link would be a little under 10 miles. Tom, what is the council hoping to discover with this trip? And could funding this be could funding it be available in the 2019 budget?
Well, the answer to the last question is yes. If the council chose to move forward with that, we do have funding available to do that. However, weather is going to prevent us from taking this trip today, so we've actually canceled it. And some other factors. But that doesn't mean it's not still on the council's radar. They're still considering it. There's a lot to talk about. There's not only the benefits that it could provide as kind of another, gateway into the Uintas from the Colville area, but there's also concerns about that because the road, Chalk Creek Road, leading up to that area, there's always concern about truck traffic on that road, and adding more traffic might be something to consider in that mix.
So what sort of truck traffic is there now?
Well, there's all sorts of, there's agricultural production in up in that area. There's oil and gas production. So there is quite a bit of activity on Chalk Creek Road.
Okay. And of course, if it's paved, you'll end up opening it up that much more.
If this section was paved, developed as a full road, then it would add other types of elements, mostly recreation, that would be using Chalk Creek Road to connect up to the Mirror Lake Highway.
Does it, where it connects into Mirror Lake, are you actually in Wyoming at
nope,
that point?
It all stays within the state of Utah and okay. Summit County.
And would it be a project that would be solely financed by the county?
Yes, it would be a county road, so it would have to be financed by the county. That's correct.
Okay. Oh, timing-wise, is that something that's 5 years down the road?
We haven't really looked at that. What we had in the budget this year was to study it and come up with a preliminary design. We're ready to let a contract like that, but the council still wants to do some consideration before they make that decision.
Okay. So there's also some discussion on the county's right-of-way, and this is prompted by the Gorgoza Water Company, which serves Pinebrook. And they want to put a loading station in the right-of-way along Pinebrook Boulevard?
Yeah, it's really a bigger discussion about how our water companies use our right-of-ways. They're a utility just like our other utilities that use the county right-of-ways to run their services. This proposal is slightly different in that they would be loading water trucks from a spring in order to sell that water. And so that it brings up a different question. We haven't traditionally required water companies to have franchise agreements, which is a pretty traditional thing to use our right-of-way. But for a profit motive, there might be reason to do that, and our ordinance supports that. But really what it comes down to is that the council has to look at the use that's being proposed in this case and how that would transfer to other utilities that could be asking for the same thing.
And is that spring water, is that being sold to some other distributor or?
I don't have the details on that. That would have to be Gorgoza Water that would give the details on that.
Okay. And do we have franchise agreements with other groups and companies?
Yes. Most of the other utilities have franchise agreements to operate in our right-of-way. For a lot of different reasons, we have chosen not to do that with water companies up until this point. However, our ordinance supports that water companies should have franchise agreements to operate in our right-of-way.
Okay. Now, the 2019 budget presentation, that's also on the agenda.
That's the big big item on the meeting agenda for tomorrow. Certainly, you know, to follow state statute, we have to present a preliminary or a recommended budget before October 15th each year. And then the process follows along that we do. That's kind of a broad overview of the proposed budget. And then we give several presentations and discussions throughout the rest of the month of October and into November before presenting a final budget, a draft final budget, the first week of December. And then we'll the council will consider, we'll have a public hearing, consider adopting the budget the second week of December.
Okay, and the overall budget is $55.6 million?
It's proposed at $55.6 million. Our revenues are projected right now at about $55.4 million, so we still have a slight gap there. We can't go into this without a balanced budget, and that's the goal as we get through the end of this. But there's you know, there's still choices to be made through the budget process, and the council will be presented those over the next month and a half.
And are you anticipating that there would be any tax increase? Or
No tax increase related to this budget. We did that last year. We went through Truth in Taxation to raise the mill levy to kind of gain back some of the lost buying power of those tax dollars over the years. One of the things that I recommended or made sure to give direction of as we went through this process is that we went out to the public last year through Truth in Taxation to make sure that we cover certain things and stay with certain values, those being that we maintain service levels, we maintained county-owned assets, so roads and infrastructure, we rebuild our fund balances. In order to prepare for the next rainy day, quote unquote, and recruit and retain a good workforce. And so my guidance going into this budget year, preparing for 2019, is to uphold those values. We did do all that within the 2018 budget. We put about $1.2 million towards fund balances, and right now we're recommending about $800,000 to $900,000 continue in the 2019 year to be put towards fund balances within that $55.6 million recommendation.
Okay, so you're trying to hit about $3 million in a fund balance?
Well, it's actually more than that because we started with some already in fund balance. We have targets in place. Ranges that we're supposed to hit. If we continue our program into 2019, we will get our general and municipal fund balances within those ranges. I'd rather be at the top of those ranges or a little bit above, as we prepare for what might happen in the future with our economy.
Sure. Who wouldn't?
Exactly.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit. There's a new deputy attorney. For the county. What is that position for? How come?
Well, the amount of work that the attorney's office has taken on over the last few years, largely around having a lot more property transactions and items related to open space, as well as excuse me, bringing our service districts kind of under the fold of our personnel policies and providing services out of our attorney's office has increased the level of work within the attorney's office. And as we propose this position, it's actually 50% supported by revenue from the service districts. So they're paying for their portion of that attorney services through the attorney's office.
Okay. So what about also on the recommendation from the Budget Committee, there were four patrol officers that they recommended, but looks like you're only putting in for two.
Yeah, I'm recommending two. I think there's a couple of things that we have to consider around that. I mean, first of all, financial constraint. There is a lot of needs within the county or things desired by offices and departments to increase service levels or programs. I have to balance the needs of ongoing programs as I recommend my budget with those strategic priorities that the council has put forward around transportation and mental health and sustainability and our general plans. And so I'm kind of balancing those needs with our ongoing service growth needs. That's where we came out with the numbers of FTEs that we recommended.
Okay. And then also getting to transportation and transit, it looks like three new employees.
Well, it actually ends up being about it's three FTEs, but it's supported by revenues outside of the general fund and the municipal fund. As you'll recall, the county imposed sales taxes around transportation and transit over the last few years, two of them this year. And those revenue sources will support these FTEs. You know, we've put a lot more revenue into the budget, which equals work that has to be done in order to expend those transportation dollars. We need to have the staff to support that. I'm sure we'll be having a big discussion over the next few weeks about transportation planning and our programs around that.
So are there specific projects that you have in mind for these three people?
Absolutely. So one of them, the transit technician itself, is we are gaining infrastructure around transit that is kind of outside of Park City Transit's purview to maintain. So that position is on the ground maintenance position for those transit assets. There's a transit planner that will be planned as a shared position between Park City Transit and ourselves. It'll be a county employee, but will sit within Park City Transit and assist with the planning of transit routes for the future and kind of help represent county equities in the program.
So like a liaison type of position.
Yeah, similar, but probably a lot more hands-on and helping the current transit planning staff and operations staff as they move forward. The last position is to provide some more capacity around our transportation planning. Carolyn Rodriguez has been doing a lot of work around implementing programs like bike share, other types of programs related to transit and alternative transportation, and we need to gain some capacity to do some more long-term planning instead of more of the day-to-day project management. So that's the reason behind that position.
Okay, great. So, Tom, also solid waste is a big thing.
It is. It's really one of our biggest sustainability initiatives that that the council adopted a master plan around this year. We really need to get into advancing that plan in order to not only reduce the amount of waste going into our landfills, but reduce that carbon footprint that is produced from the total waste stream. Everything from trucks driving around the county to pick up solid waste, but also just the waste that and the methane that's produced from a landfill. So we've got quite a few programs that were projected within that master plan to start in 2019, and we've suggested those in the budget.
Okay. It looks like we have to leave it there.
All right.
I'm sorry you're off the hook for the rest of my questions. Thanks for coming in, Tom.
Thank you very much.
Tom Fisher with the Summit County Plan or Summit County Manager. Good morning. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. My next guests are Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson and Hannah Tyler, who is a planner with the city. They are in to talk about a couple of agenda items on the Planning Commission meeting for tomorrow. The Kimball Project and food trucks. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Carolyn. Good morning.
So let's start off with the Kimball. Where are things with the roof space and the subsequent issues like traffic and noise and all those?
Well, it's been under a number of studies recently. This is almost 18 months of analysis going forward, making sure that we're consistent with state law on conditional uses and that our conditions for the project meet the community expectations about a rooftop deck. So it's a long, involved process. The city actually commissioned third-party studies to analyze the work that the applicant had done and analyze the work that the community had brought forward just to make sure. And that's a rare process where the city actually goes out, commissions a third-party analysis. The situation is generally that because the deck is not in operation, there's I'll use the word speculation, but that's not exactly the right word. There's concerns about noise going out of control. There's concerns about traffic, but we're really not going to know until we go to operations. So what we try to do is put a box around the operations and control what we expect to happen in that location. And then we have some review periods with them. We've set it up so that if there's three violations of the noise ordinance, we can remove their business license or remove their conditional use permit and make that go away. There's also a one-year review of noise and traffic. Police has been involved and parking has been involved in this review as well, and they've given us our recommendations on how to control pickups and arrivals and drop-off and all those things on Heber Avenue. So it's a balance between the rights of the public and the rights of the property owner, and we're doing our best to manage that.
Is there a comparable project anywhere that you can, point out for people to understand?
It's difficult to do that because this one's in the historic district. But we have a couple of outdoor decks on Main Street. We have the No Name. We have the outdoor deck at O'Shocks. And then we have the outdoor decks under permit in the Bonanza Park District at the Boneyard and Wine Dive. We have outdoor dining in about 20 locations in town right now. We also have other event permits in almost all of our resorts. So if you wanted to get married and have a band and do all of those sort of things, we have places that are permitted for that. The difficulty with this one is that it's a little bit closer to historic residential neighborhoods, and it's a bit bigger than what we would normally see. The occupancy load for that indoor space included and the outdoor deck inclusive is about 400 people. Right now we have some regulations in our conditions of approval that require special permitting above 200. So that'll give you an idea of why the public's concerned.
Sure. So special permitting above 200 means they have to come to the city.
They have to come and tell
time.
Us about it. We need to have police sign off on it, parking sign off about it, if there's additional mitigation strategies. And the applicant honestly has brought forward some innovative strategies on the noise in that they're bringing forward a technology that ostensibly will cut off the music automatically if it goes above our sound ordinance. And those sound meters are going to be on the building, even though we measure sound at the property line. So, as I said at the outset, until this gets into operation and we can do some actual reviews, it's very difficult to control what the outcome is, and that's why the way we've chosen to regulate this is to just put some controls on it and make it tighter and tighter and tighter if it's not working, as opposed to just assuming it's going to work and not managing.
So a little background context to this.
Uh-huh.
When the applicant first went to the Planning Commission to get approval, was this part of the discussion? Did this evolve?
It's evolved. Really evolved over time, and this has been a long controversial project. The first issues were that there were two bowstring arch roofs on this building, which is a curved roof that's on the top. There were some decisions that were made relative to whether the building could continue to be a landmark building if one of those rooftop arches was removed. That went through an appeal process, and the Historic Preservation Board and the Board of Adjustment allowed that. Once that was completed, they went to the Planning Commission for this use on the outdoor deck. That decision by the Planning Commission had most of these conditions of approval in them. To some degree, those conditions were not clear enough to the public so that they could understand what it was we were doing, and so that was appealed to the City Council. The City Council reviewed those conditions of approval and remanded it back to the Planning Commission. so that the Planning Commission could add detail, add precision, and we commissioned the two third-party studies to independently review whether the mitigation strategies could work.
And what did they say?
Both studies came back and said, yes, these are adequate mitigations consistent with your regulations and consistent with state law. In addition, we took an additional step, and Planner Gron, who's been responsible for this, Michelle Downard, who's our deputy chief building official, and one of our police officers, Che Randall, actually went out with commercial speakers on that deck, tested the noise at several levels of loudness, if you will, and then went out into the neighborhood and measured the noise at those loudness coefficients just to make sure that the mitigation strategies were consistent with what our regulations allow. So all of that combined, we're still in a situation where, yeah, it can go sideways. This is not a perfect science.
So why go with 400? Why not just back it off to 200 and say that's what we know?
That's the property owners, in effect, allowed to do that, and we don't have a regulation that would not do that. There are places where people voluntarily reduce. So we permitted a rooftop hot tub on a condominium on Park Avenue and some outdoor grills. That particular applicant agreed to reduce occupancy from roughly 100 to 49 in order to achieve the conditions of approval that were appropriate for that site. So we do have those conditions. The upper deck at the No Name has some occupancy constraints on it as well. So I think normal operations are going to go fine in this location. I think the special event permits, we're going to have to watch pretty carefully.
What is the Planning Commission doing with this then tomorrow?
Okay, so the Planning Commission is reviewing the new conditions of approval, making sure that they, one, understand what those conditions are, two, that they're clear, three, that they're enforceable, and four, that they listen to the public and see if there's anything else they can do to attempt to mitigate this use. They will then, we're asking them for final action on this. Once the Planning Commission votes, that action, I believe, is appealable again. So, you know, if the public's not comfortable with this, then they can appeal it back to the City Council or they can make another determination. But this will be the final action on this at this time.
Okay, and do you expect a lot of public show?
You know, it's not going to be 200 people in the room, but the 10 to 15 people that are concerned and adjacent neighbors will be there, and we expect to hear from them.
And it's going to be in the council chambers tomorrow?
It'll be in the council chambers starting at 5:30 tomorrow. We're going to hear the food truck work session first in order to make sure that the Planning Commission gives as much time as necessary to the public to be able to comment on this matter. So we'll hear the food trucks, which is the other thing that's on the agenda tomorrow night.
Okay, let's talk food trucks.
Oh, good.
We can move to that now. Enough of that, Kimball.
All right, so the food truck, Planner Tyler has spent a great deal of attention on this one to be consistent with the state law, and we know that our friends in the county have just been through this. We've reviewed almost all the resort towns in the West that have food trucks and special events. We took a look at what happens in Salt Lake City in order to make sure we knew exactly what we were doing. So the simple answer is this, is that in general, and for the lay people out there, food trucks are going to be regulated approximately the same way brick and mortar restaurants are. There are places where they can go, and there are places where they can't go. Second, we're not regulating food trucks per se. What we are going to do is manage food truck locations, just the same way we would manage restaurant locations. And what we're looking for is parking, setbacks, frontage protection zone, noise, garbage, and restrooms.
So where would those food trucks be if we're talking about
any place that a property owner would allow them to occur on private property, consistent with that, they could go. So the property owner would actually pull the permit, and then the food truck would act like a restaurant lessee where they would lease the space or they would get permission from the property owner to go there. We've created an allowed use permit program that we call an administrative permit. So Planner Tyler and I would review the location. If it's consistent with the way our code works, we'd go ahead and say, yep, you can go ahead and go out and ask food trucks to come to this location. So it'll be a little bit complicated in the HCB district because there's not a lot of available private property. You could see them down in the general commercial district, which would be where Silver King is, where Silver King Coffee is in the Boneyard district. It's possible you would see them at Fresh Market or PC Market. So that's step one. Step two is we're managing the food truck locations to allow food trucks on public property without a special event permit. So the Economic Development Department and our department would allow food trucks to show up consistent with our regulations at, say, Quinn's when we have baseball games or soccer matches or at the ice rink where we have those things. We're going to look carefully at the mark. If the mark wants to do a food truck once in a while, it's probably going to be okay, but it's in the neighborhood. So what we do want to do is provide opportunities for food. What we don't want to do is have people driving in from somewhere else to go get that food.
Okay.
And then the third one is food trucks during special events are completely up to the special events folks, and we're happy with that. We see food trucks all the time at the Silly Market, Kimball Arts Festival, Sundance, all of those.
Okay.
So it's a bit of a laissez-faire approach to this, Carolyn.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you for coming in. And that's Bruce Erickson. He's the Park City Planning Director. And tomorrow's meeting is at 5:30. It's in the council chambers. And we'll be talking food trucks and Kimball.
Thank you.
Thank you. So this guest is Sam Silvitis. She is a health coach and yoga teacher, and she is in this morning to talk about Ayurvedic wellness at the Lunch and Learn program at the Mark. I believe it's tomorrow. Is
yes.
that right, Sam? Thank you for coming in. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. So I always hear Ayurvedic, and I think old, I think ancient methods, a way of life. I think about a body type. Why does that
yes.
play into the Ayurvedic thing? And I don't really even know why. I don't know what that means or how it affects, you know, how someone might live that lifestyle. But maybe you can talk to us a little bit about that.
I would love to. You're actually right. Ayurveda is about 5,000 years old, so it is ancient. And it is one of the world's oldest healing sciences. It is basically the science of daily living. So it's very much into prevention, preventing disease, living with vitality, with balance. It teaches us how to live in harmony with our inner and outer nature. So our inner nature, who we are, right? We're all different. We all need different things, right? Your diet probably needs to be different than my diet. And also outer nature, the environment around us. Obviously, not just where we work, where we live, but also the seasons, the time of day. So with regards to the different body types, I think you mentioned that, they're called doshas. And Ayurveda looks at the five elements, which are earth, water, fire, space, and air. And from there, those five elements move into the three doshas. And that's kind of, Ayurveda describes everything as having the five elements, right? We all have, if you look at the earth has all five elements, but also every living thing. So we are made up of those five elements, just in different proportions. So the three doshas are the same thing. One dosha, vata, is air and space. So obviously, this time of year, there's more air and space. You can see that with the wind, the dryness, the coldness. So as we move into the autumn and the early winter, Ayurveda would call this the Vata season and has specific lifestyle and diet recommendations based on the season.
And regardless of which dosha you fall into, you might adjust that as the season occurs.
Yes. Okay. Absolutely.
So it's very complex, having to do with not just your physical surroundings, but your physical makeup. How do you begin to advise someone in this area? Where do you start?
Great question. The first place to start is understanding a little more about yourself. So we'll begin tomorrow's lunchtime learning. It's going to be at 12 o'clock tomorrow at the Mark, with looking at the five elements and how they exist within us. And for example, I have a little more fire in me than earth. So for me, summertime's a little harder because it's a little fiery outside. So other people might have a little more air and space. They might tend to be dry, a little more drier through the year, especially in Park City, right? So the first thing is identifying who you are and then looking at, based on that, what your needs are, lifestyle, daily self-care, nutrition, but then looking at some general Ayurvedic recommendations on lifestyle. So there's we'll look at both, and it's a lot to cover in an hour, but I think it'll be a lot of fun. We'll all kind of look at different examples of different people and talk about that, and it's an art and a science at the same time.
Yeah, sure. So does race or ethnicity play into the way we are evaluated?
That's such an interesting question, Carolyn. Yeah, so if you look at, let's say, more Mediterranean, olive skin, darker hair, you would say that that is more of a earth and water or kapha dosha. But yet within that, say that Mediterranean culture, everyone's a little different. So some people who have the Mediterranean background might have a little more air and space in them, vata, or a little more fire in them, pitta, than others. So again, yes, you might look at different ethnicities and different countries, nationalities, as being more of a certain dosha. But even within that, there are differences.
So, Sam, you've been teaching and coaching in Park City for a long time.
Yes.
talk about how has that evolved for you? It seems that you've devoted a career, a lifetime to this.
To health and wellness, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
I started out very differently in life on the corporate side. And then when we moved to Park City, I was home with the kids for a few years until they went into school. So when they got into school, I decided, what do I want to do? I love fitness. I love health. I became a personal trainer, and I still do that. That's what I do every day. Every day, but today's my day off.
Okay.
Or actually, yesterday was my day off. But that evolved because I saw that you can be as fit as you can be amazingly fit, you can do all the right things exercise-wise, but if you're not eating well, you're not balanced, right? And so I became a health coach. I looked at nutrition. I also looked at people who are exercising and they're doing everything right, but they're out of postural alignment. So I became a postural alignment specialist. So I kept moving in ways to help people create more balance in their life. And Ayurveda, I discovered yoga, right, because of the mental and emotional and spiritual aspects. And then from yoga, I discovered Ayurveda. And it just makes so much sense. Even though you mentioned it's complex, it is. It's 5,000 years of wisdom and science and art. But at the same time, it's really intuitive. So one of Ayurveda's teachings is to go to bed on an empty stomach. Seems kind of obvious, right? We don't sleep well when our stomach is full when we go to bed. And what's really cool is modern science is now proving all of these teachings. There's a book that just came out about Alzheimer's, the end of Alzheimer's. And the doctor who wrote it, Dr. Bredesen, said, you should go to bed on an empty stomach, because if you don't, your brain cannot rejuvenate and cleanse itself. So I love Ayurveda because it's intuitive, it makes sense, it resonates with me and with my clients, but also because modern science is now backing it up, which is really cool.
Evolving. Modern science is evolving. Well, thank you very much, Sam, for joining us this morning. That is the Lunch and Learn Ayurvedic Lifestyles that you'll be teaching tomorrow at noon at the Mark.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank
for
you so much,
in.
Carolyn. Have a great day.
You too. Good morning. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. It is 8:52, and our final guest this morning is Nell Larson. She is with the Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. She is the executive director there, and she is here to talk about arachnids, which is just the official term for spiders. And you're going to tell us about science and art of spiders.
That's
welcome.
Right.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So, all right, what can people expect with this exhibit?
Well, as you referenced, the full name is The Art and Science of Arachnids. And so we always want to emphasize that this is a friendly, accessible, safe exhibit. It's not meant to be creepy or scary. And it looks at all different aspects of arachnids. Arachnids, you know, which are primarily spiders, but also things like scorpions or vinegaroons. They actually have a really long history with people. And there's a lot of folklore and storytelling about them. They make some amazing appearances in our popular culture. The exhibit also looks at some of the films that these species have been featured in. And that's in addition to, of course, the science piece. So learn about what an arachnid is, you know, where they live, some of the cool features they have, and most interestingly, I think, see 100 live arachnids from all around the world.
So I just have to know, are these free range wandering around the exhibit space, or are they enclosed?
So they're enclosed, and they're actually enclosed sort of doubly. They're each in a terrarium, and then the terrariums are in what we call these cubes, essentially self-enclosed rooms. So you're looking at them through a thick layer of plexi.
Okay, so I guess you can learn about the life cycle of spiders. What is a spider compared with an insect? Are they the same things?
All those kinds of things.
All that
yeah,
type
exactly.
Of thing.
One of the things that I think is so interesting that I've learned from this exhibit is that spiders create 7 different kinds of silk, and each of those different kinds of silk comes from a different gland. And so, you know, silk for a web is different from silk for transportation or for protecting eggs or building a nest. And they're so much more complex than I think most of us think about on a day-to-day basis.
Do all spiders create silk?
Not all spiders, most, but not all.
Okay. And what kinds of deadly or poisonous spiders do we need to think about when we're living here in Summit County and Wasatch Counties?
Yeah. So I guess the thing I would start with is that death or serious injury by spiders is really, really rare. Each year in the U.S., I think it's something like, oh gosh, what is it? It's 4 to 6 people a year die from a venomous spider bite, which is terrifying and serious. But when we compare it to the other things we do every day, like, for example, in the U.S., 33,000 people die every year from car accidents. And so it's not something to be afraid of. Most of these spiders are they're designed, they've evolved in order to bite, you know, small prey, other like invertebrates, other insects, and maybe in a few cases, things slightly larger than that. And so it's important to remember they're not designed to hurt us, and they generally only bite in defense.
They're not predators of people.
Exactly. They're not stalking you through the night. So in the exhibit, there are a few spiders that live here in the Southwest that are featured. There's the desert, that's a scorpion. So it's an arachnid, the desert hairy scorpion, the New River tarantula, the Arizona blonde tarantula, and then also a vinegaroon. And you can see all of these. But you had also asked about deadly spiders here in this area, and there are a couple. I think most people are familiar with the recluses, like the brown recluse, and then the black widow. And each of those have very characteristic markings on their back. So you can learn a little bit about what to look for there as well.
Yeah.
We don't have those in the exhibit, however.
Oh, you don't? Okay.
We don't,
but do you have images?
There are, yes. There are images and kind of like little markers on how to identify them. Yeah.
Okay. And there's in the description, there's a hands-on part of the exhibit. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So there's kind of an interactive play area, which is great for families and kids. there is an opportunity for kids to weave their own spider web underneath this 12-foot spider arachne. There's a play table, kind of like a lab, and an opportunity to build your own arachnid from the different body parts and kind of customize your own. So there are lots of activities for younger kids as well who may not be interested in reading about the art and science behind the arachnids.
Okay. So what about, I feel like I have observed tarantulas migrating. Mm-hmm. Do they migrate at certain times of the year?
Ooh, that's an excellent question and one that I don't know the answer to. I'll have to get back to you on that one.
Yeah, I've had some interesting experiences down in southern Utah, seeing in the late autumn on a warm morning when the sun just hit the road, I've seen just many tarantulas crossing.
It was a herd of tarantulas.
And yeah. So what about this exhibit? Who has spider exhibits?
Yeah, so it's a great question that we get about these traveling exhibits in general. Like, where do they come from? And it's a real variety. We've worked with local partners. We've created our own. This one comes from a group called Build for Impact, located in Louisville, Kentucky. And they specialize in this type of exhibit, and they actually come with it and train you to take care of the spiders and how to present the exhibit, and they help move the exhibit in, which is a really wonderful thing. And so it's always a pleasure to work with a company who does this especially.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, we have to wrap it up. I could go on and on.
Can I squeeze in one more thing?
Yes.
I have to mention that the exhibit is also available to listen to and to read in both English and Spanish. So if that's something that you would prefer to do rather than reading lots of text, we have an app available. You can look at it on your phone or you can check out an iPad at the front desk.
Fantastic. Okay, yeah. What are your hours of operation? How long will the exhibit be here?
It's here through December 9th, and it's open every day, Wednesday through Sunday, 10 to 4. We do have a few free days for locals that will be coming up this fall, so keep your eye out for those. We have November 3rd and December 5th, and on those days, the exhibit will be open later. It'll be open until 7 p.m.
Okay, and that'll be a free entry day?
A free entry day for locals, and all you have to do is a reference that you're a local at the front desk.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's Nell Larson. She is the executive director with the Swanner Preserve and Eco Center, talking about the art and science of arachnids. Thanks.